What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Jesse Buttafuoco is a mental health professional, advocate, speaker, and co-victim of gun violence from Long Island, New York. Her journey in the media began at an incredibly young age as the result of a vicious attack and attempt against her mother's life in 1992. Shortly thereafter, pieces of Jesse's family story would be covered by what felt like every media outlet. However, Jesse's own experiences navigating the media, growing up in the public eye, and healing from prolonged trauma have gone largely unshared. Her goals in imparting more of what came next in her personal journey is to bring awareness to the impact and potential detriment of non-consensual media coverage, offer support to other survivors, and to change the legislative landscape for future generations. The Broken Cycle Media team is incredibly grateful that Jesse was willing to share so much of her over 30-year journey within the true crime landscape with our audience today.
Hi, I am Jesse Buttafuoco. The title that I'm currently holding is a PhD student in media psychology. In particular, my focus is on how true crime genre of media affects victims of crime. The journey to get here is a long one. So that's where I'm at today. I also have a title of Associate Marriage and Family Therapist. I've been working as a therapist for adolescents who are suicidal and homicidal for the last few years as well. Right before my PhD adventure, I received a master's degree in clinical psychology. I think at the end of the day, I am just someone that really cares a lot about people, the betterment of our souls and who we are as human beings in a society. My parents met in high school. They were high school sweethearts. At the time, my father was the class clown. He was a lot of fun. He would get in trouble a lot. There was definitely signs of antisocial personality disorder occurring in his youth. However, that was in the 70s. Mental health was not a thing. People's mindsets, personality disorders, all these terms that we know today were just not available. So my mother didn't see the sign. My dad showered her with love, affection, and gifts. The bond between my parents was very strong. They were known in the neighborhood. They're Joe and Mary Joe. It's like, welcome Joe and Mary Joe to the karaoke stage. They were a picturesque couple and had a lovely family. My dad's one of five. My mom's one of five. So we had big holidays. It was a lot of fun and it was a lot of love and support. I lived in a beautiful house in Long Island, New York, right next to the water. Had dance class, swimming, running around the beach and sunning in my hair in the summers. 4th of July parades and fireworks, riding around the neighborhood, so many kids, so wholesome and so safe. It was just an ultimate experience. My father was dealing with some addiction earlier in their marriage, but his cocaine addiction was no longer active for my dad. The sex addiction started leading him to prostitutes secretly, to filling that void, that need, and also maintaining our life. our big house next to the water. My dad was very generous, very Robin Hood of the family, but also of the neighborhood. Things fell off the back of the truck a lot growing up. So he'd come home with six pairs of Champion Double Ace LA Gear sneakers. Everybody got a new Teddy Ruxpin or a VHS system at the time. My dad is also a very good liar, and he's good at running some separate lives. At 9 years old for me, so third grade, tragedy struck. My mother was shot in the face by a teenager who was 17 years old and having a relationship with my father at the time. And it turned out to be a premeditated, calculated attack that unfolded over the course of at least 9 months, with the finale event being she knocked on my front doorstep, talked to my mom for a little bit, accused my dad of having an affair. My mom didn't believe her. And then Amy Fisher shot her in the face, then left her there to die, and tried to shoot her twice, but the gun jammed, which is a miracle in itself. Immediately after, people in the neighborhood heard the shot. They saved her life. They life-flighted her to the hospital. All my family was there within 10 minutes because everyone worked close. My grandmother heard the sirens while she was at work at church and sent a prayer up for whoever that was, not knowing it was her daughter. At this time of the shooting, my mom was oblivious to anything other than we're happy and we're in love. Their bond was so strong and so great. My mother chose to stay and defend him and be by his side through all that after literally taking a bullet. My mom comes home. She has a bullet to the face. Her face is not working. She's bandaged up. She had some really gnarly physical effects from the bullet entering the right side of her brain. It ricocheted and it lodged on the top of her spine. It's still there. It's covered in scar tissue. One thing about my mom's injury is she lost the ability to smile for half of her face. Her self-esteem was affected by that. She didn't like to take pictures. She doesn't like the way she looks. She did a great job still being supportive. And then that story became a very big news sensation. This was in 1992. So this was when media was very controlled. It wasn't like 1,000 channels on TV. There was no streaming services. People weren't watching what they wanted to when they wanted. If you missed an episode of Full House, you missed it. You went to school the next day and you were pissed because you were left out of the conversation. And so it was just a different time when it came to media production and also consumption. And so for whatever reason, this story about my parents in particular became the biggest one at the time. Immediately after, there's paparazzi outside my house. They're making comic books. They're parodying it on Saturday Night Live and in Living Color. They're making 3 TV movies out of it that all aired on the same weekend by 3 different companies, y'all. This would be like if Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon all made the same movie about the same true crime event and then aired it on the same weekend in a ratings war. My mom was shot in May. And we were on set in California by December, meeting Alyssa Milano. Seeing figures like Jim Carrey play my dad when I'm like, he's my hero. I loved him in Living Color. I wanted to be Jim Carrey. I would sit in front of the mirror and practice every facial expression. I wanted to be a comedian. People like Jim Carrey, Lucille Ball, like I grew up on that stuff. I wanted to be a comedy actress. And Saturday Night Live pitching a parody with Danny DeVito playing my dad. It was like a infomercial selling hairspray that keeps your face in one spot. People in our neighborhood would come over, record my mom, and sell that to a current affair, or would sell home movies. That exploitative piece was really hard for me to handle. We got hate comments in real time, and it's fucked up to have someone bark at you when you're eating dinner. Or driving in a car with your dad and someone says, oh, wow, Joey, you really do like him young. I'm like, this is my dad taking me to soccer. It became crazy. When this all occurred, the public reaction was very big. Everyone we knew were on Team Joey and everyone else in the public was anti-Joey. And at the time, my mom was wrapped up in that because I've been watching some old school footage of their appearance on Donahue. And listen, my father is an absolute clown. However, at the time, my mom was his ride or die and was going on TV shows like Donahue and news conferences, publicly defending him and saying, you don't know him. And it just fueled the flames. The public debate became so insane. But what's great is that I really wasn't a part of that. I'm only seeing that now as an adult and having feelings towards it. I don't care how you treated my dad, but my mother, I'm fired up because I see how they treated a gun violence victim. She was shot in the face, point blank, on the front steps of her own home, wanted nothing to do with any of this, and was just shoved into the spotlight. My father was extremely adamant that he had nothing to do with it, which of course fueled all the flames of public controversy. Us as a family believed him over outsiders that were infiltrating our life at the time. There were times I'd ask my dad straight to his face, did you have anything to do with this? No, of course not, honey. I love you and your mother too much. I would never do anything like that. You swear on my life. Yeah, I swear on your life. You swear on your dead mother's life. I swear on her life, babe. I would never do that. I chose to believe that. And I operated under that mindset for a very long time, as did my mother and the rest of my family as well, and our neighborhood and our friends. My dad is king of gaslight and denial. The people that were close to him didn't believe it, but the people in the public eye saw right through it. That's, I think, why it became such a big media circus at that time. And also, my last name sounds ridiculous. I think between my name, my parents were good-looking, upper middle-class white people. The assailant was a teenager being human trafficked herself at the time. In the 90s, she was labeled this Lolita that seduced this older man. I'm not saying Amy Fisher, who shot my mom, is an angel. At least at this point in time in my life, I'm able to see past my own personal feelings of it and look at the situation for what it is, to see how even Amy was mistreated, mishandled, exploited herself. I also think she was a working prostitute at the time. And listen, honey, sex work is work. I'm not here to hate on that industry. However, at the time, she had a black book of clients. And a lot of those clients were, I believe, public officials in the law enforcement. So all of a sudden, I think this case is becoming a lot more complicated. And if that's the case, why isn't the media focusing on that? This 16-year-old girl with a madam, like, what are we talking about here? The case itself, I've actually applied to get the files through the Freedom of Information Act. I've yet to receive those. So Amy goes to jail, but not because she went to trial. And my mom was pissed about this. They offered her a plea of aggravated assault, even though it was complete premeditated. So Amy goes to jail 5 to 15 years. Then they bring up my dad on charges of statutory rape. He gets 6 months. That whole time I was being gaslit by my dad saying, I didn't do it. I just have to say I did it. Otherwise they're gonna put me in jail and I wanna watch you grow up. I'm doing this for you. So I have the guilt of my dad's going to jail for me. Now he's in jail and he's sending me presents from jail that are like made by murderers. But at the same time, they're beautiful handkerchiefs of this adorable teddy bear with a butterfly, and my mom had it framed, and so it's over my bed. I just remember my worldview really started to change, and I was not a child anymore. The concepts that were thrown upon me because of my situation were so heavy, and I wasn't talking to anybody about it because I refused to go to therapy because at the time it was highly stigmatized in the 90s. Everywhere I went, felt like I was gonna die. I was surprised my mother did not carry much more fear, but I did. I was terrified someone was coming for me. I had my first panic attack, I think, at 9 because someone was late in picking me up and I was home alone for 15 minutes. I remember losing my shit and being like, oh, that was weird. Not even knowing that that was a panic attack, but then I was stuck there until I was 35. My mom's shooting really messed with my head because it came out of nowhere. My dad didn't claim any responsibility. So in my mind, this girl just became obsessed. Attacked my mom out of nowhere. My mom didn't do anything. On a front stoop of your home, this is early 90s, no one I knew had experienced gun violence, nothing like that. My trauma responses early on, I did a lot of regression. I was 9, and then I started talking like a baby again. And I really started to like Elmo again and Barney. I started wetting the bed again. All of those kinds of things. At the time, we didn't know that was what it was. Now that I have a master's degree in psychology, I can see what that was. Because at the same time, I also recognized that there was no room for me to have a problem. There was no room for me to be hurt. I didn't get a bullet to the face, so it's not that bad. I'd minimize if I hurt myself, or I would just pretend to be fine, even though I wasn't. I would make people laugh and try to put on a show. And then I got really into theater and fantasy, because if I could sing along to my CD of Annie, the musical, and I could pretend to be Annie and live in that hard knock life in that orphanage with singing my dancing my way through it, it was a lot easier than being me and dealing with me. I would just live in my room with my hairbrush and be Britney Spears and be Christina Aguilera on the Mickey Mouse Club. Third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, operating that way, pretending everything's fine, even though it's not, I didn't get the proper help that I needed. So I was coping through my life with the way I knew how. But then once I became older, I would say fifth grade, I would start picking cigarettes up off the floor and smoking them. Nasty girl, but they made me feel loopy and dizzy. It got me out of my head for a few seconds. I also started making myself pass out. I would hold my breath and make my face so red that eventually once I let it go and drained, I would pass out. I gave myself a concussion and didn't tell anyone about that because it's not a bullet to the face. I was pogo sticking on ice one time. Great idea, right, Jess? No, ice is slippery. Cracked my ass. Probably literally fractured it. Painful for months every time I stood up and sat down in school. Didn't tell anybody. Now I'm in maybe sixth, seventh grade. I'm sneaking a wine cooler every now and then from the block party. My friends and I are getting some Budweisers and trying them in the back at the neighborhood barbecue. Maybe it was a little early on, but my peers were also experimenting. What I did notice is that my friends were getting significantly more drunk than me, drinking the same amount, because I was so riddled with so much fear and anxiety. I became extremely hypervigilant. I was terrified that I was going to get kidnapped. I remember making a pile of post-it notes with descriptions that I could theoretically check off in the event I were kidnapped. Height, weight, hair color, vehicle, make and model. Made me feel safe having that in my pocket. Girl, what 11-year-old is doing that? I didn't even know I had anxiety, honestly, until I went back and got a master's degree and studied psychology. I just thought that constant buzz in my chest was just how you feel. I can't believe how long I operated under that mindset. And so when I look at my substance use that started early and continued on, I can see there's a direct relation. For most of my earlier adolescence, it was more anxiety, hypervigilance, fear, flashback, PTSD type feelings. But then we wound up moving from New York to California. And when we did that, my curiosity in drugs and alcohol was there, but I also didn't trust anybody at that point. At least in New York, I had my friends that I had known since grade school. When I came out to California, I was in eighth grade. I did not know one person, and I was famous by then. So I came at every single interaction with, oh, are you talking to me because I'm Joy Buttafuoco's daughter? Or because you think I have a good personality and you want to be friends? Or do you want to get to know me so you can come to my house and then tell the National Enquirer that you were there and what was on my nightstand? Because I also have experience in that. I was just really unable to trust anybody. To this day, the trust issues run deep, and it really started when I moved to California. My dad was wanting to now pursue acting or something like that. So that initiated the move out to California. When we moved to California, school orientation, I just remember looking and being like, what are these hills? What are these mountains? Where's the rain? Why is it so dry? It was such a different, even topography, landscape, people, places, things. I mean, 100% different. I did not know anybody. Considering the trauma that I had already lived, moving across country is a trauma in its own. And this whole time, y'all, I'm not thinking any of this is traumatic. This is just my life. I didn't consider my life traumatic until I had a breakdown and realized, oh, that's trauma. All my bullshit was so normalized. Fun fact, listeners, The host of this show, Amy, and I actually went to the same middle school in California. I was in eighth grade. She was in seventh grade. And we only found this out not too long ago. And now that we're here full circle, I mean, girl, I don't mean to date us, but how many years since middle school? A long time. Before we started recording, Amy shared a story with me about how me arriving to that middle school was helpful to her at that time from what she was going through. It's just very interesting that you never even know who you're impacting, especially an eighth grade girl with my braces and my short orange sun in hair with my Janko jeans. I rolled out here looking like Ty from Clueless and everyone else was looking like Cher. I was like, where are we? What is Calabasas? Why do you have pillars in your home? That shit was nuts to me. I don't know if you remember the wildfire and we had to evacuate our school. I saved everyone. And this is the story. Science class, Mr. Robbins class. Mr. Robbins, if you're still around, I put you through hell. I was disrupting the class yet again. And he sent me to the back. So I'm back there and I'm looking at the mountain out the window. And I'm like, is that fire? It's on fire. And I raise my hand and he's not calling on me. And so I start shaking it and he's still not calling on me. I'm like, Mr. Robbins, I know you just sent me back here and told me to shut my mouth, but that mountain's on fire and I'm not from here, but I don't think that's safe. He came back and he looked, he's like, oh shit, you're right. And he called the front office and was like, the mountain's on fire. Next thing you know, we are all going to the parking lot. We all have to get on buses. We all get evacuated to the high school. It's literally raining ash. There's no cell phones. I can't tell my mom this is going on. Thank God the high school we wound up going to, my brother was at the time. He's like, let's get out of here. I was like, don't we have to tell somebody? He's like, no. He drives me in his red Firebird convertible. We go home. My mom was worried sick because she sees it on the news. But like, how do you get a hold of your babies? It was something else. And this was my first 3 weeks in California. Like, what the hell is this? So thank God I opened my mouth and Mr. Robbins sent me to the back of the class that day. But that's the school that I started to get into theater. I don't know if you were there for the production of Grease, girl, but I slayed Rizzo that eighth grade year. That really helped me cope. I wasn't using substances at that time. I didn't want to be caught slipping. I needed to be perfect. I needed to be on it. And so I really escaped into theater, into perfectionism. I started really trying to be perfect at every end. But my trauma symptoms and my ADD didn't really allow me to be. So that's when she started cheating, girl. Figuring out creative ways to have that vocabulary up on my pen. So it looks like a graphic pen, but actually it's just the vocab. My TI-83 calculator, putting all the answers in it. I started also living this double life almost. I'm perfect on paper and to the adults and things like that, but then I'm cheating on the side. It made me feel icky. Once I entered high school, I worked my way up the social ladder through people pleasing, being delightful and funny and helpful. I also did everything in high school because I didn't want to be home. So I joined the swim team, which met at 4:30 in the morning, and then school, and then basketball, and then theater, and then student council, then choir, and then the theater arts workshop, and then worked at the movie theater after school. I would leave at 4:30 in the morning and come home at 10 p.m. exhausted. But when I was playing basketball, I wasn't thinking about Amy Fisher. And when I was doing other things, I wasn't thinking about all the other bullshit at the time. At some point, Amy Fisher gets out of jail because my mom was just over the parole process. Yeah. I know you know that. She was sick of going every couple of years. She was like, you know what? Forgive her, let her out. So Amy Fisher gets out of jail. She started writing a news article or something like that. She mentioned she had gotten plastic surgery so people wouldn't recognize her. Now, every time I go back to New York, maybe I'll run into her. Maybe she's going to come back out here and hurt my mom, hurt me. I don't fucking know. My parents got separated my junior year of high school. A week after my mom moved out, my dad moved in his girlfriend. He was blatantly cheating on my mom with her because I had actually walked in on them prior at my dad's shop. You once cheated and you almost got the person you love murdered. You'd think maybe you'd change your ways or not do that again. Sometimes when we moved out to California, he'd take me along to go like, meet his new friend and oh, they have a kid and you can hang out with them. I'd babysit the kid for a little bit. Dad goes somewhere. And then it turns out later he's banging that chick. My reaction to all this was the entire world is looking at my family at a negative light. And so I'm going to prove everybody wrong. I made sure that every interaction I had was delightful, pleasant, nice, and exceeded everyone's expectations. Because I knew they were going to go home and say, did you know who I met today? Joey Buttafuoco's kid. And actually, she was great. That's what I wanted people to see. I didn't want to say, and she was just like her father. Or she was a hot mess. So that was how I operated everything I ever did under that mode. During that time, my dad was on his best behavior. Things weren't really unfolding publicly much. He started working at the Rainbow Room as the door guy. If you don't know what the Rainbow Room is, it's in Hollywood. It's on Sunset Boulevard. It's like iconic rock place. I wound up having my sweet 16 there. My parents' pictures are on the walls with Rick James. It's still preserved there. It's like so 90s and early 2000s. Things were relatively good and chill. High school definitely started using more substances as well, but everyone around me was. I read a research article in one of my classes about the way in which generations drink. The generation in late 90s, early 2000s were like party, 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 binge, binge, binge. And that's what I was doing. I was just getting hammered. By the time I got to senior year, through joining all those clubs and knowing everybody, I was well-liked at my school. We were partying every weekend. For me, towards the end of the school year, you started to get a little bit more excessive my senior year. I was in the school play. I was the lead of the school play. I was playing Ado Annie in Oklahoma. The final couple performances, I was drunk. I went to college. UCSB, number one party school in the nation. 2001. During college, I was friendly, happy, nice. When I was partying, I was having a good time. I'm dancing on tables. I'm telling jokes. Throughout that whole time, I got into substances. Not only drinking, that's when my cocaine addiction really took off. Adderall. Throughout college and all of that, I was restricting and then a binge eating and restricting. I've had a lifetime of that. I didn't have my parents there, so I was able to go nuts. That's when my double life really started, the juxtaposition of wanting to be perfect but just not attaining it. And then I just partied, played sports, and became a version of myself that I didn't necessarily ever plan on being.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
I went back to school full time for clinical psychology. I got a master's degree, 4.0, no cheating queen. Because it turns out if you have a clear mind, you don't need to cheat because you believe in yourself. I like to say I got a master's degree in healing my trauma because the degree was all about writing, researching, and looking at my life and my family's life through a psychological lens.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.